That's Monty Alexander with drummer Sly Dunbar and bassist Robbie Shakespeare on Soulful Strut. It was an anthem back in the day. If you're as young as I am, you quickly recall that. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Friday, February the 22nd. Almost getting there to the end of this month, isn't it? Unbelievable how time flies. Well, I want to tell you about a cab ride that I have some many, many years ago, and why I thought it was a perfect analogy, a perfect parable for where we are, politically speaking. I was the editor of a paper, and many times, especially when a particular reporter was doing long, intense pieces, we'd go way, way, way late. I'd even go to his house and we'd just edit and rewrite and reconstruct articles and so forth. And it was one of those nights. And by the time we looked around, it was literally early in the morning, very early in the morning, and it was raining like crazy. And I just wanted to get home. So I thought, well, look, I'll just get a cab. And, of course, that's a figment of somebody's imagination, because at the time, there were no cabs, yellow cabs, really coming up to Harlem, let alone wanting to take you to Brooklyn from Harlem. So whatever it was, I said, I'm going to get through this, and I'm going to get home. As soon as I put my foot out the door, because he was going to walk me toward the main street and we'd get a cab, this thing rolls up, a yellow cab with a light on saying, I'm available. It was as if God had heard my prayer. And I flagged the cab down and got in. And I told him, look, I'm going to Brooklyn. And the faster you get there, the better it is, because I'm tired. So we take off. And we still now, we're on the streets. I mean, this is the street part of the journey, not the highway part, the street part. So he was kind of fumbling around. And I thought maybe it was that he didn't know where the entrance to the FDR Drive was. So I pointed it out, just make a left here and we get on. So we got on. And he waited and waited for his time to get on to the FDR. Not too much traffic, but raining, still raining very heavily. And we finally get on the FDR Drive heading south. Okay. But the car was all over the highway. I mean, it's just all three lanes at the same time. It was just all over the place. And I can see out of the corners of my eyes, you know, other cars that were on the road were trying their best to avoid us. And I just knew it was going to be a matter of time before we would end up in a pretty serious accident. I said, are you okay up there? He said, I see where I go. I said, okay, you see where you go. All right, fine. I backed off. We continued. Now he's driving slowly. We're driving very slowly, very heavy rain. And still, he's all over the highway. And then I looked in the rearview mirror, and I'm seeing him, and he's wearing the world's thickest glasses. The lenses are so thick, I could hardly see his eyes behind the thickness of the lens. I said, this man is not seeing where the heck he's driving. That's what the problem is. He's not seeing where he's going. I said, are you seeing where you're going? I see where I go, he says. I said, what does that sign say up there? And he says, what sign? I said, okay, that does it. That just about does it. Because the sign that I'm referring to is, you know, that big green thing that is suspended over most highways that tells you what's the next exit. That's the sign he didn't see. I said, all right, pull over right now. Pull over right here, right now. So he hesitates a little bit, and he clears the lane, and he moves over. And then it dawns on me. I mean, that was a stupid thing to do, because we are on the highway. We are pulled over. I can't catch a cab on the highway. I mean, what was I thinking? It is about 2:30 in the morning. I'm not going to, and it's raining like crazy. I'm not going to get out in the rain. I don't have an umbrella. If I had an umbrella, I would probably have thought, I will walk toward Fifth Avenue and catch a cab from there and just go home or something, catch a subway or do something. But it was just not going to happen in the circumstance I was in. So now I'm thinking, you know, you're a real idiot for pulling this guy over. He says, what do you want? What do you want me to do? I said, well, look, you are not driving like you see where you're going. And I got to get home. So there's only one thing to do, and that is I got to drive. So he looks at me and says, you can't drive my cab. I said, I have to drive. Either I drive or we both are going to get killed. Which is the better? Look, I know you are not seeing where you're going. It's so clear. You're not seeing where you're going. And you will cause a really bad accident. And we both could get hurt, very seriously hurt. So give me the keys. I'm going to drive myself home, and then I'll give you the keys back, and you get back in your cab and do whatever you want to do. But you can't drive on this highway in this rain, and you're not seeing where you're going. So he says, okay, but you crash car. Suppose you crash car. I said, I'm not going to crash car. I want to crash when I get home, okay? Give me the keys and let me drive. If you don't like the way I'm driving, you could stop me anytime and take me to the next nearest street, wherever it is, that I could catch another cab. But here we are on the FDR drive. It's raining. I can't get a cab over here, and I'm not going to allow you to drive because we're going to be in really serious trouble. So he scoots over. This is true. He scoots over and sits now in the passenger seat. He just shoved all the stuff that was on the passenger seat. He just shoved it off on the ground on the floor of this cab. And I drove myself home. He is so mad at me. He's not even looking at me. He's not even talking to me. And I couldn't care less. All I kept thinking of was, man, I can't wait to get out of here and get home and crash because I'm tired. So I get to my house and I say, all right, what's the meter say? He says, $26 and some cents. I said, all right, okay. So I'm paying him, and then I look at the man. He's just so miserable looking. But then I waited. You know, this guy took a big chance and allowed me to drive myself home. And, you know, I could have, as he said, I could have crashed car. I didn't crash car at all. So I'm grateful. So I give him a very nice, hefty tip. And he still didn't say anything. And then I got out and went home. I called my friend. I said, you would never believe how I got home tonight. And I told him the story. He said, you got to be kidding. I said, no, it's true. I flagged down a cab, and I drove myself home, and I paid the cab driver for allowing me to drive myself home, plus tip. Is that a crazy story or what? Well, I thought about that when I was considering the plight we are in as a country and what we're witnessing. It's as if everybody was just like me, sitting in the back seat of a cab, driven by people who can't see. They don't know where they're going. They don't have a clue. They can't see. They don't have the vision to take us where it is we want to and need to go. They are carrying on with their own agenda, oblivious, completely oblivious to the fact that they are there to serve a particular purpose. And the purpose is to sensibly govern. And the first rule, it seems to me, is if you're in the driver's seat, you would want, first of all, to be qualified to be there. And secondly, it isn't all about you. It's about service to the passenger or passengers. They don't care about that either. We have to fend for ourselves. And we are compelled to do it. And at the same time, we can't do it. Why? Because there is no appropriate vehicle for us to do what I discussed yesterday, which is what the Bulgarians did, and forced an incompetent and an intransigent leadership to finally concede that that definition of governance is the pits. It's wrong. It's bad. And they ought to get out. There isn't much incentive for them to make that decision. There's no palpable, visible, raucous opposition. There's no popular uprising. The people aren't in the streets like the Bulgarians did, burning their utility bills and saying, we're just not going to go along with this program. We're out of it. You've got to go. There's no constitutional provision that I'm aware of that allows the governed to declare a government null and void, to vote no confidence. And yet there's every reason to vote no confidence and to demand that they remove themselves from the positions of leadership because they do not qualify to lead or govern. And they consistently flout the feedback from the nation every single time. People are telling them, we're disgusted with you guys. We're disgusted. They say, yeah, we know, but they also know that we have no legal recourse, as it were, to fire them, to get them out, to dislodge them. Their incentive for remaining in office is that the perks are so great, wonderful perks. You get the status that comes with the job. You don't have to worry about a paycheck or health benefits. You can afford to live nicely. And you are plugged in, depending on how close you are to the nexus of power. If you are in the inner circle, you got it made. You get information, insider information from the Department of Treasury or whoever it is will tell you, well, interest rates are going to go up at such and such a date. You act accordingly and you send the word to your investor and you tell them what to do for you, your financial advisors, and you get rich overnight. You have friends who are wealthy and would like to be wealthier. You facilitate their wealthy aspirations and you get contracts to them. You know, there are lots of perks. It's like Hillary Clinton saying, well, I went to 120 countries. Well, you know what? It's not like you had to hitchhike to get there. You didn't have to swim. You had the best planes with the best pilot, with the best cabin service. And when you landed, you got the best limo to take you to the best hotels and where you ate the best food. And if anybody believes that it was only about U.S. government business, then you're naive. Half of that time was going to countries in which the Clinton Global Initiative had interests. So they are merchandisers. They're no longer government leaders. They are entrepreneurs of politics. Their election to office is a means to an end. And the people, we the people, are like those booster rockets that propel the main payload into orbit. Lots and lots of energy we have to expend to do that, to lift these folks into political orbit. And as soon as they get there, as soon as they arrive at their desired height, at their desired altitude, the booster rockets are jettisoned. Where they end up, who the heck cares? They're no longer useful. They're no longer relevant. They're just dead weight. And that is how pervasively in government the power equation operates. The people we elect are grateful for the fact that we elect them, and that's about all they can think of in terms of gratitude. They have no further use for you. So we are in the back of a taxi, and the drivers can't see. And what's worse is they won't see, even when you point it out to them, even when you give them direction. They just are not interested in you. You're just too stupid. What do we know? Why should they listen to us? We have to decide. We have to make a decision fairly quickly that we have to be prepared to take the keys. Take the keys. And that means in the upcoming midterm elections, we just take them out of office. We decide who gets priority on the list, and we just take them out of office. Makes no distinction whether they're Republican or Democrat. Just take them out. But of course, people are so emotional about this thing called the vote. Especially black folks are very, very emotional about this thing called the vote. How many people, how many dogs, how many water cannon did we have to suffer? And that is precisely my point. If you value your vote because of the sacrifice, you will never allow it to be so meaningless. You will be compelled to protect the integrity of your vote by making a smart decision. The smart decision is to see that these leaders are not leaders at all. And if they are leaders, they're not the leaders that we need or want. We should be working like crazy right now, working at the community level to construct a healthy alternative. And any alternative at this point, in my mind, is healthier than what we've got. Get them out. Get them out. Put them out of our misery. No other country in the world would tolerate this level of contempt. We have a president running around the country now, like if he's still campaigning, and he's not paying attention to the real things that matter. He's paying attention to those things that he thinks register emotionally with certain constituencies. The vast majority of people are having a very rough time, but that's not who they're interested in talking to. He says it's the middle class. Even the president is using code words. He's using code words now. The middle class. That's two black people, 1.5 Latinos, and probably zero Asians. He knows who he's talking to. We have all this, these obscene tricks, these political games that are being played. And yet on the flip side of that is a lot of suffering, a lot of sacrifice, a lot of inconvenience, a lot of misery, a lot of poverty. But when you have a Senate, almost 100% millionaires, they can't possibly relate to a person who doesn't know where the next meal is coming from. When you have people who are touting their Harvard degrees over here, you know, Harvard practically has a monopoly on government right now. You would think that the purpose of the U.S. government is to employ Harvard grads. And if they were good Harvard grads, I wouldn't mind, but they're not even good. The guy who is going to head up the Treasury, Mr. Liu, Jack Liu, doesn't have one bit of international experience, international financial experience, none. He's got a Harvard degree. So that makes him perfectly suited. I wonder what's going on with our president. Is there something in the water down there that makes people lose their minds? So we have to use the power that we have, and we have power. We do have power. We have power. And the power that we have is the power of this vote and the power to protect it. This is the thing. Don't just vote and walk away. That is disregarding and disrespecting your vote. In fact, you are compelled, because you have the right to vote, to protect the integrity of that vote. And that means you mobilize and you organize and you get these scoundrels out. And we have to find a way to constitutionally provide a way to declare a government null and void. We have to find a way to do that. That ought to be a constitutional right. They're telling us you have the right only to elect. And we unelect them, but we'll have to go through the voting process. What kind of garbage is that? This is year five. Year five. This is more than enough time for a turnaround, a change of opinion, a change of stance. 5 years. Is the expectation that we're supposed to ride it out the next couple of years until the next presidential election, and then we have our chance to unelect? The suffering is occurring now. The punishment ought to be administered now. And don't get emotional about it. I say, sounding very emotional. It's passionate, all right? Passionate. If the suffering is occurring now, our capacity to punish should be contemporaneous with that. I have, as you know, a major beef with the Democratic Party. A major beef with the Democratic Party. And we will now have to constantly remind ourselves about the origin of this party. It was the party of the Klan. These folks running around here talking about all that democracy and what, they don't believe in it. If you believed in it, you'd go through the process and not govern by executive order, playing all those dirty tricks, and think people are just too stupid. But of course, we're not Harvard grads. Harvard people constructed this, so they must be smart and smarter than the rest of us. But I want to tell you some good news. And I got it because it's something that had been on my mind for quite some time. And that is the power that we have. The power to take care of business. If only we took ourselves seriously and our interests seriously. I used to say all the time, we have to be ruthless and obsessive about our interests. And increasingly, we also have to be far more accommodating and far more enlightened about the way we go about taking care of business. We could never, ever continue to concede power that we have. We have it. So why don't we use it accordingly? We have it, it's ours. Why don't we use it accordingly? I want to remind you of a little, well, it's not a little thing, it's a very big speech in a little bit of time. Before we go to the break, I want to share this with you. If you had any doubt at all about the power of people, here is a strong reminder.
A young slave boy stood one day before the greatest ruler of his day. And God said to Moses, "What's in your hand?" And Moses said, "Lord, only I've got a stick, that's all." He said, "Well, let me use what's in your hand." And God used that slave boy with a stick in his hand to divide the Red Seas, march through a wilderness, bring water out of rocks, manna from heaven, and bring his people to freedom land. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? George Washington Carver, who was so frail that he was traded for a broken-down horse as a slave boy. And George Washington Carver, sitting in the science laboratory at Tuskegee, told me, he said, "Dr. Powell," he said, "I just go out in the fields each morning at 5 o'clock, and I let God guide me. And I bring back these little things and work them over my laboratory." And that man did more to revolutionize the agricultural science of peanuts and of cotton and sweet potato than any other human being in the field of agricultural science. What's in your hand? Just let God use you, that's all. What's in your hand? I've got a string in my hand, that's all, and I'm flying a kite. And way up in the heavens, lightning strikes it. And I, Benjamin Franklin, discover for the first time the possibilities of electricity with a string in my hand. What's in your hand? Little hunchback sitting in a Roman jail. I haven't got anything in my hand but an old quill pen, but God says, write what I tell you to write. Paul wrote, "I have run my race with patience. I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. Henceforth has laid up for me." Slingshot, and the enemies of my people are great and big and more numerous than we are. Well, little David, go down to the brook and pick out a few stones and come on back and close your eyes if you want to and pull back that slingshot and let it go. And David killed the biggest enemy, the leader of the giants, against his people, and his people became free, just letting God guide a stone in his hand. And a few years passed, and David is a king. And God says, "What's in your hand?" He said, "I've got a harp in my hand." He said, "Well, David, play on your harp." And he played, "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Taketh me to lie down in green pastures. Leadeth me beside still waters. Yea, though I walk through the valley in the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? Man hanging on a cross. I've got two nails in my hand. Father, I stretch my hands to thee. No other help I know. If thou withdrawest thyself from me, whither shall I go? And that man with two nails in his hand spit history and half, B.C. and A.D. And what's in your hand tonight, people of Cambridge? You've got God in your hand, and he'll let you win because he's on your side and one with God, always in the majority. So walk with him and talk with him and work with him and stick together and fight together. And with God's hand in your hand, the victory will be accomplished here sooner than you dreamed, sooner than you hoped, sooner than you prayed for, sooner than you imagined. Good night and God bless you.
Well, that was the great Adam Clayton Powell with a timeless speech, What's in Your Hand. We'll take a break and come back at 888-874-4888, and you tell me what you think is in our hands when we get back.
Tony Hendra
and Jeff Chrysler
of the Final Edition Radio Hour
on PRN,
your source for organic,
gluten-free,
sustainable
satire.
This is Dr. Jack Rasmus, your host for the Alternative Vision Show every Wednesday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Join me this coming February 27th when I'll be talking about the March 1st deadline for Congress to cut another $1.2 trillion in so-called sequestered spending. Will it happen? What'll be the cut? What's the likely effect on an already slowing U.S. economy? Join me next Wednesday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, this is Richard Martin to remind you that I'll be looking out for you on Mondays and Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time to give you the latest from the financial world and to let you know just how bad things are getting. I'll be telling you things you'll never get to hear in the mainstream media. So join me here on the Wake Up Call. You can listen to the show at any time from the archives, and if you like the show, rate us on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartgleff, host of It's All About Food. And this Tuesday, February 26th, I'll be talking about, well, food, healthy food, and the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine's Food for Life program with Joe Gonzalez and Danielle Pryor. Food for life. I'll eat to that. Listen, call in with questions, and learn from two nutrition experts in the plant food world here on the Progressive Radio Network. It's All About Food this Tuesday, 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time.
This is PRN.FM.
PRN.FM.
The number one station for progressive minds.
Progressive minds.
You're listening to PRN.FM, Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. So, how do we tackle this business of bringing a government into account? What's in our hands as you see it? Sarah from Dallas, you're on the air.
Great to see you, Eutrice.
Thank you.
Yes, by the way, let me go ahead and wish you an enjoyable weekend. You said you have a Facebook page for the show.
Thank you. Are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. What's in our hands? What's in the people's hands?
Well, Eutrice, as you said, the good analogy that you made about us being booster rockets, that once they get up into space, outer space, clear the atmosphere, we get dropped off somewhere, maybe in the Pacific, since we are one-time use. So, in our particular case, I don't believe that we have anything in our hands. All we have is just a ballot, and the ballot is not worth anything since corporate America has basically taken over all political parties. In order for you to run for elected office, you have to be able to raise at least, even on a local level, at least $1 million. If you want to run for school board president or whatever, you have to be able to raise that type of money. And most people are not, don't have that type of money in savings, and even if they did have it, they're not going to take that money to go and spend it on an office that is not guaranteed that you're going to get into it.
But you're telling me what we don't have. I'm interested in what we do have.
We have ourselves, as you said, we have ourselves that we can do something about ourselves. Exactly. These people, as you said, in office, we can go ahead and try and remove them from it. But I really think that the horse has already left the barn, and we are just basically trying to shut the door with nothing in there as valuable. Because we have let this stuff crept along for so long that now it is pretty much red amok. We're just going to have to tear it all down and start over, Utrecht. That's what I'm looking at.
Okay. Well, it's a kind of a bleak prognosis that you're giving us, Sarah. What do we do in the meantime? Do we just sit passively and watch what's going on and tolerate it?
No, we fight to the very last, as you said, what's going on, because Utrecht is with this president about to appoint another so-called Ivy League grad to this post of the EPA, another white female. So we are seeing that there's no diversity in his administration. Black women are not given anything. Of all the so-called blacks and Latinos, he had four blacks. Two of them have left. The Latinos have all left. So there is no diversity. It's always old white men or older white women. There is no diversity. And for them to make it seem as if though there are no qualified black women or men out here who maybe went to an HBCU or something less stellar university and has the know-it-all to be out here to handle a position of government, it's very, very disingenuous. It's making it seem as if though all black folks are good for is for entertainment purposes, to run with a ball in our hands and to sing on stage and shake our booty. We don't have any intellectual width is what this is coming down to. That the only intelligent black man supposed to be standing there is the President of the United States and no one else.
Well, thank you, Sarah. You got the conversation started. Thanks so much for contributing. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. That speech by Adam Clayton Powell, of course, was framed in the context, much of it, biblical context, but you got the point. The point is, in the face of insurmountable odds, there also is a record of challenge, successful challenges. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yeah, by the way, where did you find that speech?
Oh, I got this speech from, I think, a YouTube clip.
Oh, yes? Just put in Adam Clayton Powell?
Yes, you should find it.
And something in the end? Okay, well, I'll see if I can find that. Yeah, okay, when the hand is, got a pen in the hand, and you fill out the ballot on election day, that's one of the things you have in your hand. Also, and you have to protect that ballot because, you know, people want to do strange things with them. I think there should be some sort of way where all the ballots, you know, should be able to be published on the internet so people can be able to count the ballots in their own district, you know. And the technology is there, and it's not expensive.
Do you believe that we have? I mean, the people who say, and we all say it all the time, so we end up talking to each other about the same thing. We all are disaffected. We all are disenchanted. We all are dissatisfied with where things are. Do you get a sense that there is an organizing aspect around this dissatisfaction that is credible?
Well, you have to have an agenda, and you have to be able to, you know, publish that agenda, and you have to have candidates that follow that agenda.
Do we have the makings of that? Do you see any evidence that things are moving?
You have to be able to recruit candidates to run for office, and you have to get on the ballot, and you have to basically, you know, go from door to door and collect signatures to get on the ballot. But you know, we got November 2014 to get it together. Well, actually, earlier than that, you have to get these ballots together probably this year. I mean, you have to try to get it on the ballot this year, okay? You want to get your candidates on the ballot this year, and there has to be some sort of major organized effort around that, getting, you know, candidates and the agenda together this year so we're ready for next year.
All right, John, thank you for your contribution. It's imperative, the right to vote, since we have it, and since we say we value it, what are we doing to protect its integrity? Or do we continue the cycle of having people just desecrate the heck out of our right to vote? If we don't show that we respect our right to vote, then nobody else will be required to respect it. This is the point I'm making. We talk all the time about what folks are not doing and or what they're doing that we can't change. And the evidence is so clear that inevitably, because of the process, they still have to come to us because winning requires our votes. How do we leverage that? And how do we protect that investment? The vote is your investment. How do we protect it? What is going on now? What is passing for leadership at almost every level of government is ridiculous. At the federal level, it's beyond ridiculous. It's embarrassingly ridiculous. This is what the United States has come to, with a bunch of miscreants in Congress who can't agree in 5 years, going on for 5 years, they cannot agree and work cooperatively in some way that advances the interests of millions, hundreds of millions of people. And we dare to demand accountability and transparency and democracy from all these other countries abroad. We dare to do that. We dare to situate ourselves as leaders of the world, demanding that people come up to our standard? No, it's that they refuse to come down to our standard. How different is it? Is it because it's smoother and it feels a little bit more velvety that we could tolerate these abuses here that people will not tolerate in other countries? This is absurd that this is the leadership that we have, and more so absurd that we have no mechanism to shut them down. They're now even talking about the Democrats moving, in fact, to shut the government down just to show the Republicans. And they're playing these kinds of games. And people are not in the street. People are not surrounding Congress. People are not showing up with their pitchforks and shovels and saying, listen, as they used to do in the old days, you will not do this. You look at all these countries that are supposed to be so backward, where people are on the line. They're not tolerating abuses of government anymore. And there's no question that what is going on in the United States is tantamount to abuse. These are human rights abuses. These are constitutional abuses that they are actively involved in, which means it now has a conspiratorial nature to it. But if we let them get away with this, we now have to accept the fact that we should just shut up and go away and never say another bad thing again about government. Because when we had the opportunity, and the opportunity is now, to correct it, we faltered, or we were too cowardly to do anything. Let's reconsider the message today. What's in your hand? What do you have that you can use to create change? Paul, we will have a short answer from you because we're running out of time, but I couldn't leave you without saying, having something to say.
Well, I will say thank you for the program as always. And
thank you, Paul.
In terms of politics, I think that's one way. Everything is politics. But in our daily lives, I think there, when I live in Brooklyn, and there's so many people who live in houses by themselves. You know, they're not on the streets. They have a house, and they live in it by themselves. And there's so many students who, and children, who need a caretaker, so to speak, someone to guide them. So when you ask what's in your hands, I think there's so much. We're so wealthy, and we don't seem to understand what we have, and it's being chiseled away, and we still have something. And what is in our hands, there's so much, so that we can look out for those around us, because they're getting very cynical, and I don't blame them.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks so much. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I want to thank you for listening and for participating and for encouraging others to do so, to take a look at PRN.FM and certainly this program, but not just this program. All of the programs are worth a nice little look at. We need to grow this audience because this is an organizing medium. This is the way we get to air our thoughts and share our ideas and opinions. And it begins to have a multiplier effect. So let's get a bit aggressive about this and pass the word along to those in your sphere of influence or spheres of influence and help grow this family. I really appreciate your help. And, of course, I look forward to hearing from you at leadstories@gmail.com. And you want to stay tuned and stay attuned. How about that? Richard Martin with Wake Up Call is next. Thank you and have a good weekend. Bye-bye.